Hey, this is our fifth time together. So, how have you been inside your hula hoop? Did you have any inside your hula hoop adventures this week? We're going to explore today a fascinating realm inside your hula hoop that I think you're going to hear some things today, hopefully. I don't believe you probably have ever heard before. I mean that in a good way. I just think it's going to be brand new information for you, and I think it'll be somewhat impacting, maybe life-changing, but I think it might make a difference in your life. So there's a big world inside our hula hoop. So if you've noticed, personal growth inside our hula hoop is a very, very important factor to harness our growth so that we can have a chance at having the best relationships possible. So life does not guarantee us automatically great relationships because we really are not in control of the other person, right? We don't know what they're going to do. But we can learn to be the best that we can be and do the best that we can do. So, while living life inside your hula hoop, did you have any interesting adventures this week where you learned something? Did you feel yourself in the gravitational pull of another human being? Did you feel the pull within yourself to dance your old dance? And that you decided, I'm going to break up the pattern, manage myself, be humble, I'm not going to participate and do my same old thing. Have any of those adventures? Oh, hey, go ahead.
I did.
What adventure did you have?
Well, I always want to make sure everybody understands. If they understand, then they won't be upset, all right?
There you go.
And if I could just explain it, then they'll get it.
If you could get your truth inside their hula hoop,
then they'll understand.
Then they'll get it.
We'll be hunky dory. We'll
exactly.
Together, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, Jerry and I had a little local thing, so I almost understood something.
Right.
And all of a sudden, he just. And Jerry doesn't do
right.
that much
right.
very often, but he did. And I'm like, whoa, what was that all about? I don't know what that was.
Let's say his hula hoop started vibrating. Yeah. Okay. We had a vibrating hula hoop over here last week.
It was wobbling. Then all of a sudden I went, okay, never mind. I just kind of stepped back and I thought, I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to
okay.
do that.
Yeah.
I'm not going
to. Right.
And all I said was, I don't know what you thought, but I'm not going to own this.
Okay. And I'm not going to own this.
And then we went about our day and everything was hunky dory.
Right.
And at the end of the day, we're at Costco, stocking up for this event. And I looked at him and I said,
what happened?
I said, you know, I started off the day saying, we're living the dream, baby. We're in the ministry, our house, doing all this.
Right.
And then all of a sudden he goes, and he said, yeah, then the law happened. I said, we just started laughing so hard I thought I was going to wet my pants at the top.
Okay, wait a minute. I want to make sure we get that line on the video. We laughed so hard I thought I was going to wet my pants at Costco. There you go. You know, you change the pattern up, you never know what you're going to get.
Now Jerry can say his side of the story.
Well, now wait a minute. When you say now Jerry can say his side of the story, there's room for two, and those realities don't have to line up exactly.
And I'm sure they don't.
I'm sure they probably don't. Yep, that's good. Good adventures inside your hula hoop. Hula hoop adventures. We'll just start a blog. Hula hoop adventures. Are you noticing any patterns if you get into the gravitational pull of a person who is significant to you in your life? Pay attention. What might you tend to do? Because whatever that is telling you something, and you can at least identify it and then try to decide who do you want to be, what do you want to do with that. I don't want you to automatically live that pattern out. At least have a choice. And you're growing. We're trying to move from automatic living to conscious living. Even if you can't do what you aspire to do, at least you're on the journey. And that's a good thing. Okay. So, I'm sorry, one more. There you go.
I was just gonna say, I love the last thing you just said. That even if you venture up, because I just this afternoon, I was talking to my cousin
right.
in California, and he said, it would happen in a matter of seconds.
Yep.
The point is, his verbiage to me was, you need to agree with me.
Oh, there you go.
And I interpreted what he said to be that.
Right.
But I was, even though I didn't respond to the way I had wanted to, mm-hmm. in my likelihood, like
yeah.
you're saying,
mm-hmm.
I think that I caught the fact that I didn't.
Oh, good for you. Yes, very much so. That's part of the journey of growth. Sometimes we can catch it on the front end of a pattern. Sometimes we can catch ourselves in the middle of the interaction. Sometimes we miss those two opportunities and we live the whole thing out. But I would tell anybody, you can still look back and learn. It's okay. That's how learning takes place. I couldn't do it the first 10 times, but I'm at least aware and I'm catching myself. And I'm on the journey because I see it more. And now I can learn to do it in the middle. And I can even catch it on the front end. And then you really feel hopeful. It's like, Now sometimes you'll go, oh, that one got me. That one came out of left field, a curveball, and I just acted the whole pattern out. That's okay. That's all right. Show yourself a little grace and write down maybe the triggers and what happened. And you'll get it. With practice, you'll get it next time. That's what growth is about. Okay, let's return to where we left off, really. And I know it's a little repeat, but I love this example, and it's easy to remember. Three umpires are sitting around over beer after a game, and one says, there's balls and there's strikes, and I call them the way they are. Another one says, as I said last week, au contraire, as if an umpire is really going to say that. There's balls and there's strikes, and I call them the way I see them. Now the third umpire really, I think, has the trump card, and he says, wait a minute, there's balls, there's strikes, and they ain't nothing until I call them. Now it's that view that I want you to hold on to, especially today as we're talking about emotions inside your hula hoop, what creates emotions, what emotions tend to do in relationships, and what emotions will tempt us to do in a relationship. I want you to understand it's part of being human. However, I want you to be aware and learn really what's going on. Okay? Now, it's one thing to have emotions. It's another thing to understand what creates them and what they drive us to think and do. So, do you understand the first umpire and his view of reality? There's balls and strikes. I call them the way they are. That's an objective view of reality. A tree is a tree is a tree. A tree will always be a tree. Reality is there. We just see it, perceive it, and we name it for what it is. A ball's a ball. A strike's a strike. Got it? The second view, reality, is perceiver dependent. It's all subjective. It's in the eyes of the beholder. I call them as I see them. So the emphasis is on the subjective. The third is a constructionist view, and it's an interaction between the objective and the subjective. And that's what you're going to see and learn about emotions. Now, I know I said this last week, but a little bit of review. Emotions, can you trust them? Good. You learned. And you're going to learn where the answer is, I'm not so certain that I can trust them. With legitimacy, you're going to understand what happens with emotions. But yes, 100% you can trust every emotion that you have to tell you about you. Not about other people. And maybe not even about the situation or circumstances you find yourself as your brain interacts with the objective world. You're going to see why. You can always trust an emotion that an emotion is reflecting a category in your brain, a learned category. The two will always match up. I'm not so certain it matches your real life situation. You can misinterpret and get things wrong, and you will have a real emotion. You may be having a panic attack. You may show up in the emergency room. You may ask to see a cardiologist because you are convinced you're having a heart attack. I assure you, thank you. I assure you, you're not having a heart attack, but your brain is telling you that you are. You are ascribing your symptoms and it's choosing a category. Yes, you can trust them to tell you about something inside you, inside your hula hoop. That's why you're going to have some fantastic adventures inside your hula hoop. You can always learn inside your hula hoop because a lot's going on. All right? So, we looked at this diagram last week. Even though it was all mixed up, I have a better iPad this week and I have a better PowerPoint presentation. I trashed the old one because I looked them up and they said they're going out of business at the end of 2018 and the website was taken down. So, got a new one. The ABCs of emotion. Now think of A plus B equals C. Think of A as affect. So something affects us. Some guy cuts us off on Central Expressway or LBJ and won't let you merge. Let's say that is the trigger, the stimulus. Or you're at a social gathering like today and somebody sees you and doesn't acknowledge you, doesn't say hi to you, and you go, what is that all about? Right? You're aware of a stimulus, and I would like to say at this point, the hula hoop that you're in starts vibrating. A stimulus makes a neurological response in your body. So clinically speaking, if you wished to understand this, emotion is a neurological vibration. It's a neurological activity in your body. A feeling, happy, sad, frustrated, angry, a feeling state is when your brain labels it. Emotion is a neurological incident in your body. Through your senses, touch, taste, smell, hear. But your brain is going to process that and it's going to give it a label. Then it's a feeling state. You are consciously aware of a feeling state. All right, so I know that we say my hula hoop starts vibrating because that guy cut me off. Fair enough. Or that person walked in the room, they didn't say hi to me, and what was that about? And I feel hurt, sad, disappointed, angry, upset, demeaned, put down, whatever. Lots of labels, lots of words. I like to say on this side, when I'm working with people, when your hula hoop starts vibrating, it means something matters. That's all. Pay attention to the vibration when you feel it. Something's mattering to you. It's mattering. Something's vibrating. You were at a place of rest and calm. Now something's vibrating. Let's understand what's vibrating. I know we like to say, hey, A directly causes C, and that guy who cut me off, that person who snubbed me, caused me to feel what I'm feeling. I feel angry. I feel upset. I feel hurt. I feel sad. You caused it. You know that triggering event? It caused it in me. It produced it in me. So we say, we jump from A to C. We have emotions, then we have feelings. And what do emotions and feelings usually lead to? Actions and behaviors. So here's what you can always think. Emotion usually sets something in motion. I always want to know, when you felt that, what did you do? It's interesting. When you were aware of the vibration, just try to understand. What did you do next? Emotion drives behaviors. You did something. How'd you process it? What'd you do? Where did it lead you? Where did it guide you? Because you have an inner guidance system. So emotion usually sets something in motion. So what do you see? What determines what? And I hinted at this last week, Albert Einstein. What do you see and what determines data? what set of glasses am I looking through? Because if I have a tinted green set of glasses, everything looks. If I have gray glasses, everything looks. Depending on the gray, depending on the filter that I'm looking through, I might then see data I otherwise can't see. So Einstein said, it is wrong to assume that theories, I put interpretations, you're going to see why later, are based on observation. I put solely. It is wrong to assume that theories are based solely on observation. The opposite is the case, he said to a group of scientists. The opposite is the case, he said. The theory we already hold in our brain determines what we're able to observe. Does that make sense? You remember last week when you said, if you spot it, you got it? Unless I have some kind of concept in my brain about what a tree is, I won't be looking for a tree. I am blind to what a tree is. So I've learned a concept of a tree. So the difficult thing about this, which we'll see later, is we tend to see what we already know. We push out new novel stuff. So if you're trained as a therapist and you're totally cognitive behavioral therapist and that's your training, you'll only tend to see through that lens. You'll eradicate any other data because you're viewing all the symptoms through one approach. Does that make sense? All right, so if you have a hammer, it is said everything is a nail. So the problem about a specialist is we can only see through the specialist set of glasses. And I could miss, or like a detective who already deems a suspect to be guilty, he usually finds confirming data to already prove what he already thinks. Do you know what that's called? Confirmation bias. I thought you were a bad person before I met you. Now that I've met you, you did two or three things that confirmed to me you are a bad person. Because I had a set of glasses on that was looking for it. I was viewing you automatically prior to meeting you that I didn't like you. Now you have to go against my internal set of glasses and interrupt them to disprove what I'm already believing about you. Usually that never works. Because whatever you do, I'll flip it and use it against you to confirm. If you're nice to me, I'll say, you're just putting on airs. You think you're something. If you're not nice to me, I say, proves it. You're a bad person. Because I was already holding an a priori set of glasses. Make sense? All right. Remember Epictetus? He is the Greek slave. His name means acquired. His name means property. It's not his given name. It's how we know him, Epictetus. So he was a Greek, and he was a slave of a wealthy Roman. He was born in 55 AD. So I don't know when he was acquired, but by 98 AD, he had already gained his freedom, and he set up a school of philosophy in Rome. And when Nero came to power, I don't know if you knew this, beyond persecuting Christians, in AD 98, Nero was fed up with all the philosophers and he kicked all of them out of Rome. So Epictetus had to leave Rome, set up a school someplace else. Now here are some of the things he said. You're going to see how smart, brilliant this guy was even way back then, because you're going to see how it ties into modern brain science today. He said, the appearance of things to the mind is the standard of every action to man. Ponder that. How things appear is the basis for why people do what they do. The appearance of things. In a word, neither death, nor exile, nor pain, nor anything of this kind is the real cause of why we do or not do any action, but our inward thoughts and inward principles and guidance mechanism, not the thing external, because it comes into our brain and we process it in our brain, that causes our action, not the external thing itself. He says, how do I know this? Because what disturbs one man's mind is not the events, but his judgment of the events. How do I know this? He says, because what distresses one person in one event doesn't necessarily distress another. So two people could be at the same event and totally process it differently. He says, so it can't be the event itself. It has to be how people process it in their brain. But his judgment of the event. Isn't that brilliant? So two people can be at the same thing and have completely different experiences. So it can't be the event itself in his philosophy. He said, practice then from the start to say to every harsh impression, something that comes in your brain, and in Greek I love this word, fantasia. Fantasia. To every fantasy, fantasia, you are an impression, and you are not at all the thing you appear to be. You're just a thing to my brain. You're just a fantasy. You're just an impression. Then examine it and test it by the rules that you have, which we don't have the rules that he gave, but he gave some. And firstly and chiefly by this, whether that impression has to do with the things that are up to us or the things that are not. Sounds like the Serenity Prayer, doesn't it? First part of the Serenity Prayer, change the things you can, accept the things you cannot, and God give me the wisdom to know the difference between the two because I keep getting them mixed up. Whether the impression has to do with things that are up to us or those that are not. And if it has to do with things that are not up to us and not in within your control, be ready to say, it's nothing to me. If it's out of your control, what's it to you? If it's out of your control, what's it to you? If it's within your control, do something with it. All right? So we understand that there's a B element, and A does not necessarily cause C. Now this is critical in relationships, and you're going to see why in just a little bit. Because everything that happens comes in and through our brain. Everything. So when you're asleep and I'm asleep and your brain is shut down, you have no conscious awareness of anything, you're dead to the world. Look, the world's still going on, but it's not passing through your brain. So would you agree that the tree in the forest that falls while you're asleep or 100 miles away, it fell, correct? It fell. With or without your permission, it fell in the forest. Right? Did you hear it? No, because sound and hearing, we've introduced a subject. There is no sound without a receiver. There's a sound wave. There's a disturbance in the universe. If you want to call that sound, there's a wave. We don't call it sound, just like emotion is a wave. We don't call it a feeling until the brain labels it. You don't call sound sound until you hear it, until there's a hearer. So the answer to the question, the tree falls in the forest and nobody's around, did it make a sound? No. It made a disturbance in the universe. It created a wave. But a sound takes a perceiver, a receiver. Got it? Make sense? Now, if you want to label sound as automatically including the concept of whether it's a receiver or not, perceiver or not, okay, it made a sound. It made a sound wave. But it made a wave. So everything has got to pass through our brain. This means the brain is going to label whatever neurological disturbance we're having that we call emotion. We have a belief. And when a person walks through a room and we see and observe, they didn't speak to me. Your brain's going to struggle for why, isn't it? It's going to find a meaning. It's going to assign a meaning to it. Then you will feel an emotion. So if you say, they're arrogant, that's an interpretation. Right? I don't know if they're arrogant or not. How do you know they're arrogant? They appear to be arrogant. Okay, they appear to be arrogant. I don't know that they're arrogant. All I know is they walked through the room and didn't say hi to you. Right? They walked through the room, they saw you, they didn't say hi to you. Well, they think they're better than me. That's an interpretation. That's a story your brain created to make sense of real life data. They walked through the room. All I know is they walked through the room, didn't say hi to you. You don't know why, but your brain will struggle to find a meaning for that, and when it finds a meaning, you'll feel an emotion. Dependent upon the meaning your brain makes. Still with me? Go ahead.
There's a saying that they have in recovery circles, and it kind of keeps going through my head throughout all of this. It's that feelings aren't facts.
I like that. Because feelings are the result of an interpretation of facts. That's right. Feelings aren't raw data. Feelings are the result of a brain's interpretation of the data. It assigns a meaning, an interpretation, depending on perception, and it's going to get even more complicated in a wonderful way.
There's a quote by Eleanor Roosevelt that said, "No one can make you feel inferior without your permission."
Perfectly said. No one can make you feel inferior without your permission. It's how the receiver takes it. The behavior is the behavior. Right? You don't know why they didn't speak to you. Maybe they're preoccupied. Maybe one of their loved ones has been in a car accident. Maybe they're having the world's worst day. Maybe they've been to the doctor and they found out they have cancer. You have no idea, but your brain will come up with a meaning. So this is where we have to be careful. All brains will come up with a meaning even when there is none. Your brain will fill the gap and create a story. It wants to create a story.
It's a choice.
And that's what we're going to talk about, is how to understand this. If you can understand how it operates, you've got a shot at not suffering needlessly about your brain's interpretations or go-to data bank, and you're going to see. So we have our set of glasses. We assign a meaning. Then we tell a story. I don't know if you were able to. If sometime, please do. There are two chapters, there are three on the website. One, Master My Stories 1. And this is about get the story straight in your brain that produced an emotion before you go talk to your boss. It's out of the book, Critical Conversations, business book. They wrote a second book called Crucial Conversations. So I included that chapter, Master My Stories 2. Because they're going to talk about, before you go talk to your boss and you're all upset and you're mad, or your supervisor, and you've got a lot of emotion going on, make sure how your brain interprets the facts and the story you came up with is directly producing your emotion, and now your emotion's driving your behavior. Okay? So, we tell ourselves a story, we assign the event a meaning, we have a set of glasses, we have a perception, and we tend to believe we're correct. So, stay with me. Let's understand what your brain is doing, because this can bring you some real freedom, and I think you'll find it fascinating. Now, let's say the brain takes in data from the senses. Smell, touch, sight, all hearing. The brain is amazingly aware of the body. It's taking in, it sees, it hears something. Sensations are experienced. Now, when this happens, the brain seeks to make sense of its present data by drawing upon a data bank in your brain of past learned experiences to give possible meaning to the present. Did you get that? It's got a library back there of all of your past experiences, but it's not a direct coded library. That library is fluid. It's not the Library of Congress where that material is clear there today as it was 15 years ago. Memory is fluid. The neurons that create memory are fluid. They ebb and flow. We misremember. We empower certain things. We misremember things. We think we're so correct. We're not. So it's a living organism, and the brain is going to draw upon its best guess for what it's currently experiencing. It's going to retrieve from the data bank of all your past experiences, and it's going to give possible meaning to the present. So the brain selects a past learned experience. You could call this an a trapdoor set of neurons in your brain. It's attracting the brain to go to these couplings because several couplings line up and your brain says, that's what's going on right here. So if you're in Afghanistan for do a tour of duty, then you come home, how has your brain been wired to survive? Correct? So when you meet people, you're not sure whether they're an enemy. You see an IED device, some strange thing on the side of the road, and you've been near one, and it's blown up your Humvee, and it's killed a couple of your favorite people. Your brain is going to be on high alert, correct? So when you come back to the States, what? Did everything just wash clean and life's good? It's probably still on high alert, saving you. And it's skittish because it's drawing upon a data bank that's very real. So the brain selects a past learned experience and a tractor. It goes to a concept learned and it links it to the new present experience. It constructs and simulates. What I want you to learn about the brain is it's predicting, constructing, and simulating. Like a Google search engine, when you type in the first five words, what does Google do? It completes because 10,000 millions of other people have searched for that, and it's speeding you up to do a shortcut, correct? It's a shortcut. But by doing so, it's eliminated many other options, hasn't it? Now, we go, oh, that's the one I want, and you click on it, and it goes, 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 goes. But it's based on usage and storage, it's going quickly to complete the gap. That's why your brain may feel like it's getting triggered. Actually, what it's doing is it's forecasting at a lightning speed and predicting, based on your current circumstances, what it thinks you're about to experience. It's going quickly as a Google search engine, and it says you're having a heart attack right now when perhaps you're not. But once you become fixated on that, it's going to duplicate your body sensations, and now it feels so much like you are. It's a self-fulfilling cycle. So the brain selects a past learned experience, an attractor, and links it to the brand new novel experience it constructs and simulates in your brain so as to understand, interpret, give meaning to what's going on right now. That's why it isn't necessarily objectively clear that you're objectively correct. It's just pinging back to your nearest understanding, and it can get it wrong. Because it's just going to your nearest learned category. So if you're in a brand new learning experience, brand new learning experiences, by definition, aren't in your brain. Does that make sense? So you may think you're going to die. I'm going to die. I'm going to die. But if it's a learned experience, you go, I've been through this 100 times. I'm not going to die. Correct? But at the beginning of the experience, you think you're going to die. Right? For those lawyers in the room, if you've ever been in a lawsuit, it's, as a human being, it's tremendously terrible, distressing, and you think, I'm going to die. What's your attorney think? Yeah, we're going to kick their butt. I've been through this. Yeah, they're power posturing. They're scaring you. They're going to threaten to take your children and take your home. And I can see that. I got this. And you're like, you really got this? I'm going to die. I'm going to die. I'm going to lose everything. Are you kidding me? Well, they're just messing with you. Okay. The attorney's been through it a million times. Like, yeah. So you spend a year in jail. It's not bad. I saved you 15. Yeah, it's okay. So this process that your brain is going through is called simulation. It's actively simulating, forecasting, and predicting. Now, to you, to me, it feels like I'm getting triggered. Okay, call it what you will. It's happening so lightning fast, it's predicting and simulating inside your brain and flashing it up on a big movie screen. So, watch what your brain does so that you can help understand the concept that I just described. Ready? What do you see? Okay, Pac-Man. What do you see?
Two triangles.
Yeah, but you see what your brain is doing? Those aren't two triangles. Your brain is constructing them. Those are just lines. Your brain is pinging to its nearest learned concept, and it says, that's a triangle. No, that's a line here, a line here, and a line here. None of those lines are connected, correct? But your brain, is the moment it sees it, it goes to its nearest approximation inside your brain and says, I know what that is. That's a triangle, right? But literally speaking, those are just lines that are disconnected. So your brain went to its nearest learned category to say, I know what that is. Right? Let's go again. What we see, hear, touch, taste, smell, and feel. We're going to get to the emotions. I'm laying the... All of this is the same in the brain. Are simulations of the world constructed by our brain, not reactions to the world. Simulations, plural, are our brain's best guess, interpretation, going to the data bank, as to what's happening right now in the world and in our body. It's its best approximation based on learned categories it's drawn from in your brain. Every waking moment, our brain uses learned concepts, attractors, to simulate the external and internal world. Without these, we are experientially blind. Because your brain is constantly interpreting what's going on right now between me and you, and it's pinging back to its nearest learned concept. And it's telling you. Now, I didn't say it was foolproof, because your brain is not infinite. You don't have an infinite data bank. You could be mislabeling what's actually taking place in front of you. Make sense? It's its best guess. Physical sensations in our body have no meaning until our brain assigns a meaning to them. This includes our emotions. Our brains construct emotions. It labels them. You learned what anxiety was. Somebody told you. You learned it. You learned what happiness was. You learned what sadness is. Those words in and of themselves don't have any meaning until you learn them. Correct? You don't know what a lemon is. Right now, if I say lemon, you immediately in your brain see a yellow fruit. If I said the word lemon in Chinese or German, your brain would be experientially blind, right? It wouldn't flash up a picture of a lemon. It would just hear a sound. Still with me? So the brain constructs and simulates. The advantage, the brain's use of past learned concepts enables to move through life with speed and quickness. It's like a Google search engine. Completing the sentences immediately in interaction with a human being. It's firing. The disadvantage, the brain's use of learned concepts means that past experiences can misinform the present. You can get it wrong. And new experiences in the present can blur your past. They interact with each other. So they can get in the way. So, due to how the brain learns, we are predisposed to be more aware of what we have already seen, already have heard, hear anew what we've heard most often, and think what we've always thought and feel what we've mostly felt. Did you hear that? Due to how the brain learns and activates and simulates, we are predisposed to be more aware of what we've already seen, less aware of brand new things, because we are experientially blind to them. Correct? We hear what we've most heard, think what we've most always thought, and feel what we've most always felt. That's why, have you ever heard the term paradigm shift? Why are paradigm shifts difficult? What is a paradigm shift?
Changes in your thought, right?
That's right. You're experientially blind. So let's say for hundreds of years, people believed the earth was the center of the universe. All right? Think how long it took with data to make a shift that was not the case and that we're revolving, orbiting around the sun. How long do you think that took? No, I don't mean the orbit. How long do you think it took for people to... Oh,
no.
Okay. From the beginning of time.
From the beginning of time until...
That's right.
And they kept trying to come up with more and more intricate theories of why that wasn't true.
That's right. Even the Catholic Church condemned Galileo, excommunicated him, because he was clearly going against Scripture, which proved the earth was the center of the universe. Scripture was the final word. So... we could say, in scientific work, we find that new theories are understood only by our graduate students whose intellectual identities are wholly transformed by the new theories. In contrast, our senior professors are burdened with such connectional inertia that when they encounter new ideas and new theories, there is no apparent effect on them other than an occasional vague irritation. Why? Yes. Hey, what happened? There we go. Yes, they have all these concepts. That's why if you're doing your PhD dissertation under a dyed-in-the-wool committed Freudian, analytic theorist, and you're doing it in a new wave of therapy, it's not going to go well. Most of the time. Because they're processing it through all their decades of how they understand the human being and the data, and they're going to go, that's not right, that's not right, that's not right. Because it doesn't fit into their a priori assumptions about how people operate. So, the challenge here is, as you can understand, the sine qua non, do you know what that phrase means? The bottom line without which there is nothing, legal term, without which there is nothing, the essence, without the sine qua non, without this there is nothing. The bottom line of a neural network in our brain is its penchant for strengthening neuronal patterns directly in proportion to their use. The more often we think, feel, or imagine a thing, the more probable it is our mind will revisit its prior stopping point. Why? Why? It goes to what it's most familiar with. Have you ever stomped down tall grass in a field to make a path? The first time you did it took a lot of work. You're just sludging through everything. The second time you walked that path, was it easier? Third time, fourth time, what's happening? No, because now you're starting to make a groove in the ground. Let's say horses and ox carts now begin to go, what happens in the ground?
Ruts.
Ruts and grooves. The very same thing is happening in the neuronal network in our brain. A material record, neuronal pathways are being formed. The more you write with your right hand, the easier it is to write with your right hand. Because information flies down that because it's already been trodden down. What if you break your hand and you have to write with your left hand? Is it flow? You have no neuronal pattern for that. It's going to take repetition, 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 and repetition till you finally start to flow. So you're treading down tall grass, tall grass. You still with me? The more often we think, feel, or imagine a thing, the more probable it is our mind will revisit that very thing. Stay with me. We're going to get there. You're being so patient. The same is true with emotions. The more you feel a thing, the more you're going to feel a thing. You're training your brain. Our brain interprets according to context, just like the meaning of a word in a sentence. Nothing, that word is nothing apart from its context in a sentence. Your brain is assessing the contextual situation that you're in, coming up with a ping-back concept, and it's saying, this is what you're in, this is what you're in. This is my nearest approximation to give you a guidance system. So look at this. What do you see? Good. She's good. Look, what we call that is deconstruction. She deconstructed it and didn't interpret it. But tell me what you see vertically. Tell me what you see horizontally. Your brain contextually interpreted the center point as to whether you went horizontal or vertical. In the middle, it means nothing. It's only the context that determines. Your brain had to decide which one depending on whether you read it up or down. What about this? What is it? A misspelled word. That's right. Because that middle letter is nothing. If you take it apart and put your fingers over the T and the E or the other letters, we don't know what that is. You could say, well, my brain interprets it as an A. That's an interpretation. Technically, it's not an A. It's a figure most approximating an A. But you put it in T and E, it's an H. But your brain forced an interpretation. Still with me? Tell me what you see.
A man screaming.
Mm-hmm.
Or laughing. Or crying.
Mm-hmm. If I led your brain, if I led the witness in therapy, ooh, back to legal terms here. If I lead my client, which I'm careful not to do, I could lead you by saying, this is a photo of a woman after the Rwandan genocide, after discovering her family had been killed. Make sense? That's Serena Williams after she beat her sister, the U.S. Open. So you were right. How did you know what it was? But your brain, what was your brain's immediate interpretation? Pain or laughter? Aha! So your brain assessed it and said, my nearest approximation about making sense of that is that woman is in tremendous pain. And I could have led you, when this was used to help us, it was said to us, obviously, we recognize when people are in pain. So my brain immediately went, oh my gosh, that person is in pain. Then they showed us the next photo and said, no, I can lead your brain and tilt your brain, because you don't know what it is, but your brain is forcing an interpretation and says, I think I know what that is. Well, you could have a lot of actions based on what you do next, based on a misapproximation of what's really going on. Make sense?
No.
Yeah.
Is this why the Rorschach
yes.
is a valuable technique?
Uh-huh. It's, even though it's old analytical, the Rorschach is a bunch of ink blots on a paper. What do you see? is telling about what's inside of us, not what's on the paper. So, stay with me. Now we're into emotion. If you see now how the brain simulates, activates, interprets, makes meaning of every given situation, it's also drawing upon past learned emotional concepts. By the way, the more you learn a neuronal pattern in a relationship, the more you will be drawn to that relationship that has that neuronal pattern. The more you're married to an alcoholic, the more you will seek out another alcoholic. The more you are married to an abuser with a neuronal pattern that has trained your feelings and emotions in a pattern, the more you will seek that out and return to it because it's a familiar pattern in your brain. A brand new pattern you are experientially blind to. Somebody who can love you well, you are blind to them. Because you don't have an existing concept in your heart and your head and your brain to match, so when you can't feel it, you're most likely going to duplicate patterns that you grew up with. Because your brain was trained to grow up with those patterns. I didn't say they couldn't be broken. I'm saying you're going to be experientially blind and naturally drawn back to a familiar pattern. I didn't say the pattern was good for you. It's the way the brain learns. So an emotion, a feeling, is our brain's best, speedy construction, interpretation, creation of our body sensations in relationship to what's happening around us. Our brain draws from previously learned emotional categories to interpret the present of my body sensations. Am I feeling anxious? That's a learned concept. Am I worried? Did you know your body's same physical sensations, same ones, depending on the context, your brain could interpret as exciting adventure or dreaded anxiety? Same body sensations. Same pounding heart rate. Same blood flow. Same chemicals coursing through your body. But your brain will assess and it will say, I think I'm going to die, or this is the world's greatest adventure. Make sense? So your brain is interpreting your body sensations and assigning a label to it. Our brain interprets in relationship to perceived context. Our body sensations in one context produce an emotion relative to that situation. But the same body sensations in another can produce completely different emotions. Stay with me. That's why fear, threat, and anxiety and pounding heart rate and adrenaline coursing through the body can be also a sexual response system. Your body's responding and the wires can cross and the brain can associate harm, physical abuse with sexuality. Same body sensations, but the brain is learning to associate both. So you get abusive relationships that are highly sexual. Same body sensations, but the brain's wiring is now become accustomed to the more pain you feel, the more eroticism you experience. That's why murder can be an exciting serial murderer that produces a high. The brain is learning that activity, which can be felt in other instances in our life. So emotions are not triggered. They're active constructions drawn from a data bank of which we are active participants in that construction. Our brains are predicting and forecasting, interpreting the event contextually, then choosing a label. The more we link a sensation on our body with an emotional concept, the stronger the neural pathway, the quicker the brain will link it, like a Google search engine, to that emotion. The more you feel it, the more you'll feel it. Oh, isn't that powerful? The more you feel it. So this is what I want you to see, because now we're going to drill down after we take a break. Now that I've laid the theoretical foundation, events do not cause nor create what's inside of us. The brain simulates and predicts events stimulate, evoke, expose what's already there. You didn't cause it in me. You revealed it in me. But the way everybody wants to use emotions is they want to blame everybody for their emotions. You caused me to feel this way, and I'm going to tell you about it. That's it. Really, think about it. I caused it? Yes, and you're responsible for them. Oh, wow. Makes for a great relationship. This is where we're going. This is what we do. But I want to flip it and go, wait, time out. They're not causing it. They're revealing what's inside of you. You learned this in a prior setting. It's being evoked in you and your brain is going there. Can we learn from it versus blame everybody and cause blame and fault? Look, if the traffic on Central Expressway or wherever is causing you anger, what's your only solution? If it's external to you, what's your only solution to never feel angry? Yes, always avoid 75. But think about that. We're the world's biggest victim, if that's the case. We're denying any personal responsibility when actually we can learn from it because it's being evoked in us. Every person's brain creates meaning. Every person's brain fills the gaps and creates meaning by pinging back and selecting its most similar concept. We can learn a great deal about ourselves, less about everybody else. I can learn about me and my hula hoop and blame you less. But if I'm going to be on the blame game that you caused me to feel it, then I got to get you to own it and take responsibility for it. Good luck with that. Because somebody's going to look at us one day and say, I'm not going to be 100% responsible for what you feel. Well, you made me feel inferior. You walked in the room and didn't say hi to me. I am so upset with you. I'm going to confront you. Does that make for great relationships? Can't you just wait to sit down to talk to a person who's confronting about us making them feel inferior? Oh my gosh, I'll never do that again. Well, I'm sure glad we solved that. Thank you very much for owning that. What did I own? Next time I come in the room, I'll be sure to say hi to you. Okay. Now we're talking. Now you're hearing me. Yeah, baby. Okay. Lord forbid me for forgetting to make eye contact with you. Woo! Take a break. Now we'll talk about the exciting things of what to do with all this.